News. I'm Nicole Livis. U.S. lawmakers will travel to the state of New Mexico this week as they search for answers about how a Guatemalan girl died while in U.S. Border Patrol custody. The family of 7-year-old Jacqueline Call is disputing an account from U.S. officials who said she had not been given food or water for days. In a statement, they said she had been given food and water and appeared to be in good health as she traveled through Mexico with her father. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen says that death illustrates the dangers of illegal border crossings.
It's heart-wrenching is what it is, and my heart goes out to the family, all of DHS. This is just a very sad example of the dangers of this journey. This family chose to cross illegally.
The young girl died of what medical officials initially determined as sepsis shock. Official accounts indicate she received a quick assessment, but it took too long to get her to the hospital. Officials from around the world have agreed upon a set of rules to govern the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. Chairman of the talks, Mikhail Corteca, said the accord is just the beginning.
We will all have to give in order to gain. We will all have to be courageous to look into the future and make yet another step for the sake of humanity.
President Trump has said the U.S. will pull out of the Paris Accord. The U.S. military says it has killed 8 members of the al-Shabaab extremist group with an airstrike. No civilians were injured. That airstrike happened south of Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. The U.S. says it welcomes actions Pakistan is taking to promote a negotiated solution to the war neighboring Afghanistan. The acknowledgement came a day after Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan announced his country has arranged a next round of Washington's peace talks with the Afghan Taliban scheduled for Monday. Neither Khan nor the U.S. spokesperson have disclosed the possible venue for that upcoming meeting. This is VOA News. Sri Lanka has a new prime minister. Ramil Wickramasinghe has been reinstated. He was sworn into office on Sunday. Mahinda Rajapaksa had replaced him not long ago, but Rajapaksa resigned on Friday. He had been unable to win a necessary vote of confidence in parliament to function as prime minister. Yellow vest protesters are occupying dozens of traffic roundabouts in France, even as their economic reform movement appears to be losing momentum on the 5th straight weekend of demonstrations. Watch out! 8 people have died in incidents tied to the movement, mostly from traffic accidents linked to roads blocked by protesters. Reuters' Lauren Anthony reports demonstrations were more subdued nationwide on Saturday.
But authorities have noticed a drastic drop in turnout, with around 33,500 protesters counted in France so far, compared to 77,000 around the same time last week. Government officials and opposition politicians called for protesters to stay off the streets this weekend after 4 people were killed in a gun attack at a Christmas market in Strasbourg earlier this week.
The protests started in November against fuel tax hikes, but have morphed into a general expression of anger at the government of President Emmanuel Macron. President Trump is pushing Congress to come up with a replacement for the Affordable Care Act, even as the White House says the so-called Obamacare will remain in place for now. Law professor and health care expert Timothy Jost says because the Affordable Care Act covered so many aspects of health insurance for those getting it themselves or from their employers, like pre-existing conditions or coverage for children up to 26, this ruling affects almost everyone.
The protections of the Affordable Care Act extend to every form of insurance coverage or public program coverage in the United States, and people will lose those protections if this judgment stands.
The U.S. Education Department said it will forgive $150 million in federal student loans as part of the 2016 rule that Secretary Betsy DeVos previously tried to block. Department officials have begun notifying 15,000 students their loans will be automatically erased because they attended colleges that closed while they were still in school or shortly after they finished. About half of them attended campuses under the for-profit Corinthian Colleges chain, which collapsed in 2015 amid widespread accusations of fraud. President Trump says his scandal-plagued Interior Department Secretary Ryan Zinke will leave his administration at the end of the year. Zinke's departure was Mr. Trump's second high-level personnel announcement in less than a day and the latest to leave the administration under a cloud of controversy. Get all the day's news on voanews.com. I'm Nicole Livis, VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington.
Wengwa, in particular, his deputy, who comes from the Mashonaland provinces, is one man who is known for his burning ambition to become president of Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwean ruling ZANU-PF party endorses President Emmerson Mnangagwa as its candidate for the next general election.
We would like to hear from the ones that are contesting the election. Also, we would like to have a debate in Lagos State between the APC candidate and the PDP candidate, because we have an interesting contest here in Lagos State, which is the commercial capital of Nigeria.
Nigerian civil society and opposition groups demand a presidential debate before the February poll.
There is no need to go into an election on December 23rd only to have the result of the election rejected by the majority of the population, which is going to lead to violence.
And a Congolese presidential candidate demands an independent inquiry into the destruction of voter machines to be used for next week's presidential election in the DRC capital, Kinshasa. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa has been endorsed by the ruling ZANU-PF as its presidential candidate for the next election in 2023. Critics describe the move as odd, particularly when Mnangagwa was recently elected president in November 2017. ZANU-PF supporters say the nomination seeks to unite the party after a report of infighting in the run-up to the last polls. This as the president plans to release a report about the post-election violence which left 6 people dead and dozens injured this week. For more, I read George Nkwananzi, a Zimbabwean political analyst.
It's not surprising that ZANU-PF has decided to nominate Mr. Mnangagwa as their presidential candidate for the next election, which is 4 years away. Because this is a party historically that has been led by a geriatric in the form of Robert Mugabe, who had to be forced out of power when he was already 93, thereabout. Now, they consider Mnangagwa as a much younger person, when in reality he's actually, you know, up the hill. You know, he's not really fit to be having such responsibilities as running a country. He has reached his prime, run out of any ideas. Remember, he has been part of Robert Mugabe's government for nearly 40 years. We don't expect that there's anything better that he will offer, particularly, you know, with the advancement of age.
But George, the move some supporters of the ruling ZANU-PF party are saying is to end speculation that President Emmerson Mnangagwa will step down after only one term in office, which could lead to a clamor and disunity within the party.
Yes, that much we appreciate, but I don't think that a party like ZANU-PF, a seasoned party like ZANU-PF, will run out of options. Emmerson Mnangagwa is not the only person who can lead ZANU-PF, you know, to the future. They have many younger people, you know, not even one of the deputies, because they are also perhaps too old. They could have, you know, identified a younger person. The next 4 years is long enough for them to have identified a successor, groomed him, put him close to where he would learn, you know, the mechanics of running a government and getting acceptance by the generality of the ZANU-PF membership. But for them to try and solve their internal issues by creating a problem for the whole nation, it's not taking us forward as a country.
So what do you make of the suggestion that ahead of the recent presidential election, there were sections of the ZANU-PF that did not like Emmerson Mnangagwa because of the way former President Mugabe was treated. And so this is part of a move to silence those factions and to ensure that members of the ruling party coalesce ahead of the next general election. What do you make of this?
I actually do believe that it's true that there were actually substantial number of ZANU-PF supporters were not happy with the way Robert Mugabe was deposed, particularly in the northern provinces of Mashonaland. Because you can see, even when you look at the current crop of leaders in charge of Zimbabwe right now, they reflect a situation where there's been a shift of power from the northern provinces to the southern provinces, so to speak. So, yes, there is that obsession with the attempt to try and keep the party together and as well as protect the leadership of Mnangagwa from those that are disgruntled. So, but I wouldn't say that that's the only constituents of ZANU-PF that they were trying to keep away from perhaps sabotaging Mr. Mnangagwa. Even some of his deputies, particularly one of them coming from the southern provinces, may have positioned himself strategically to take over and may have been the cause for the narrative that Mnangagwa was going to step down after one term. So it could be more of a strategy against the current internal dynamics of ZANU-PF more than the attempt to block out those that were sympathetic to Robert Mugabe. Chiwengwa, in particular, his deputy, who comes from the Mashonaland provinces, is one man who is known for his burning ambition to become president of Zimbabwe. And this could be one of those things meant to put him at bay so that he doesn't disturb Emmerson Mnangagwa as he runs the country for the next perhaps 9 years or so to come.
George Nkwananzi is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. Nigerian civil society and opposition groups are calling for a presidential debate before the February 16 polls. Their calls come after a vice presidential debate broadcast on national television Friday, a first in the country's history. The groups said a debate would enable prospective voters make a better informed choice for president. So far, former Vice President Atiku Abubakar from the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, has announced he will be a willing participant. However, it is unclear if incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari will take part. For more about the debate, I read Judy Chukwani, an economist and political analyst based in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Yes, Nigerians see it as a very, very welcome development. A lot of people tuned in to watch it. It drew a lot of interest from Nigerians, and it gave the Nigerian people an opportunity for the first time to be able to assess who might one day enter the seat of number one. And they were also able to listen to the candidates that were there and judge for themselves the programs and what they intend to do and to handle all the problems that are bedeviling the country.
Were they satisfied with the range of issues that these candidates addressed?
Yes, I believe so. I believe the questions that were asked were marginally okay. Even though people were saying they needed more debt, they covered a wide range of things, but some of the most controversial issues were fixed. So maybe, at the presidential level, maybe those issues will be considered.
But did Nigerians demand that before the presidential election, there should be a debate between the main contestants for the presidency?
Yes, there's a great, great yearning and demand by Nigerians, and Nigerians are looking up to our foreign partners to help us put pressure to ensure that there is a presidential debate, because it is extremely important in any democracy. The people must hear from the people that want to lead them. That's what democracy is all about. So we are looking up to the U.S. to put maximum pressure and demand that the presidential debate be held before the elections.
Some Nigerians were saying the vice presidential debate should have been between the two leading parties, talking about Professor Oshibanjo from the ruling APC, as well as Dr. Peter Oji from the main opposition party, the PDP. What are your thoughts?
It should have been that, but at the same time in Nigeria, we have a saying, the young shall grow. using that thing in the Young Shark Group, the other candidates that came, at least for the very first time, women in Nigeria saw fellow women standing there and making very, very serious statements and tackling issues and putting forth very serious program of line of action. You know, so it was good that the opportunity was given to other parties that had a women candidate to be there in order to balance the gender. So it was a good thing. There were only five of them, so it was out of 72. There are 72 candidates contesting, so five is okay.
What was the criteria used to select these vice presidential candidates?
I guess the organizers of the debate, Born and whatever, they must have consulted some oracle somewhere and selected the other ones. Nobody can tell you what the criteria is. It's all speculation.
So overall, what was your take of the debate?
Yeah, overall, I believe it was okay. I would have wanted that instead of just a single moderator, they would have had other people to come, either select them by balloting, some form of balloting, give wider choice, to the media in Nigeria for them to participate. And number two, the questions, they would have used the technology and selected the questions from the audience digitally. People would have sent in questions through Twitter or whichever platform you want, and then digitally those questions will pop up and will show on the screen. You know, they would have made use of technology, which is already available in the country, in order for Nigerians to have wider participation and also in order to promote the whole essence of democracy, which is government of the people by the people. So they should have allowed the people to participate by asking questions.
Did the organizers say there could be another round of vice presidential debate before possibly that of the presidential debate?
I don't know. I think the next step, man, because the elections are in 2 months, so if elections are in 2 months, I think the next thing they should concentrate their efforts is to have a presidential debate. And after that, if they have time, they can have another round of vice. Because vice presidents are not the ones contesting for election. The people that are contesting for election are the president. So we would like to hear from the ones that are contesting the election. Also, we would like to have a debate in Lagos State between the APC candidate and the PDP candidate. Because we have an interesting contest here in Lagos State, which is the commercial capital of Nigeria.
Chudi Chukwani is an economist and political analyst. He spoke with me from Abuja. A Democratic Republic of Congo presidential candidate is calling for an independent investigation into a fire that destroyed voter machines reserved for the December 23 election in the capital, Kinshasa. Noel Chiani says there's need to find and punish the culprits who he says want to undermine democracy. Meanwhile, the Electoral Commission says it plans to administer the poll on schedule despite the destruction of most of the machines. To learn more about his demand for an inquiry, I reach independent presidential candidate Noel Chiani.
I am demanding an independent investigation into the burning of the voting machine in Kinshasa because the conditions are very suspicious. We are within a few days from the December 23rd, 2018 elections. It is totally unacceptable that some people have organized to burn all the machine and the government properties. We want to know the truth. Who is trying to sabotage the process so that we can continue as a country to live in generalized insecurity and with illegitimate leaders who have who are out of their legal mandate. So it is very important for all of us to know the truth, and the only way to know the truth is to have an independent investigation, possibly an international investigation also, into the burning of these machines.
Emmanuel Shadary's camp, the ruling party coalition, released a statement about looking into it. I heard CNE is also trying to look into the circumstances leading to the burning of these voter machines. Are you not pleased with these efforts coming from these two groups?
Well, I'm not pleased at all because we know that since 2016, There have been a lot of political maneuvering to try to maintain the current regime going on without handing over to a democratic elected government. So today, Shaidari's camp, which is President Kabila's camp, for them to be accusing some members of the opposition in this burning of the machine, I think that it is too easy to make that kind of statement. So the only way to know the truth is to have an independent investigation which is going to tell us exactly what has happened and what led to those machines being burned.
I understand the burning of these voter machines has increased tension, particularly in the capital, Kinshasa, and other political parties, as well as you being an independent candidate. What is your response to some of these concerns being expressed about tension, which they said could possibly lead to violence, with less than 2 weeks to the presidential election on December 23?
Yes, indeed, there are a lot of tensions here in the capital, Kinshasa. As you know, we have many pending issues on which we don't have a very clear consensus. For example, even the use of the voting machine, there is a portion of the population which is rejecting those machines, another portion which is supporting the machine, and those who are supporting are basically people from the ruling party, and the opposition in general, they have been opposed to those machines. But some of us, we've been saying the only way to reach a consensus will be to have a meeting convened by the CENI, which is going to include not only all the presidential candidates, but also the Westminster Foundation, which has done an audit, of the voting machine and made a number of recommendations to make the machine safer for use. But also the Organisation Internationale de Francophonie, which has audited also the voter rolls list. And made also a number of registrations. So as we stand today, we do not know what CENI has done to implement all those recommendations. And I personally am asking the CENI to convene a meeting with all the key stakeholders, the CENI itself, the opposition leaders, the Westminster Foundation, the Organisation Internationale de Francophonie, and the civil society, so that we can examine one by one all the pending issues and come to some kind of consensus, so that if we go into this election on December 23rd, we will have reached a consensus on what has to be done, because there is no need to go into an election on December 23rd only to have the result of the election rejected by the majority of the population, which is going to lead to violence.
But Cornel Enanga told VOA that his electoral commission, or CNE, has been meeting with all stakeholders, including political parties, to resolve any of your concerns ahead of the elections. Why aren't political parties bringing some of these concerns for him to resolve ahead of the election?
Well, because the issues, although Mr. Nanga and the CENI have been meeting some key stakeholders one by one, but I think that there is a need to have a meeting that will be attended by all the key stakeholders at once with the CENI, so that all of us, we can hear the CENI story and hear also some of those organizations which have audited the voting machine and the voter registration roll, and then see really if what was recommended was done. So there is no need to have meeting one by one privately. There is a need to have that general meeting that will be attended by everyone, and that's the meeting that I am calling for.
Noel Chiani is an independent candidate for the DRC presidential election. He spoke with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Meanwhile, the December 23 elections in Congo are the most important in more than a decade. After delaying a new poll for 2 years, President Joseph Kabila is stepping aside. Two main candidates are vying to replace him, one his hand-picked successor, the other an opposition leader. VOA's Anita Powell spoke with the two main camps and brings us this report from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa.
After 2 decades under the Kabila family, Congolese voters face a stark choice as they go to the polls on December 23rd. Continuity or change? Longtime President Joseph Kabila is stepping down 2 years after his mandate expired. His departure from the top job has opened the door to a flood of 21 presidential aspirants and thousands of people jockeying for lower offices. But in this crowd, only a handful of names stand out. Little-known former Interior Minister Emmanuel Ramazani Shadari is Kabila's choice to become Congo's next president, and he is campaigning heavily on that relationship. I was chosen as candidate for the presidential election by President Joseph Kabila, he told a crowd at a campaign rally in Swahili. But Shadari faces stiff competition from a fractured but passionate opposition, including from the son of the late longtime opposition leader. Félix Tshisekedi, who is widely seen as the frontrunner, entered the race late, after the opposition chose another man as their coalition candidate. That coalition candidate, businessman Martin Fayulu, told VOA he's confident that voters will back him. However, an October opinion poll conducted by international and local think tanks only gave him about 8% of the vote.
We want to leave after us, you know, the old bad things that Mr. Kabila has done in this country. Corruption, you know, insecurity, the mass killing. That should be something that we have to make a big cross so we can move ahead and change things in this country.
But he says he's not sure this election will give him that chance. And on this point, the divided opposition sings in the same key. They believe this poll will not be free, fair, or transparent. An area of particular concern is the electronic voting machines that opposition figures have repeatedly described as rigging machines. Adding to that, the government has refused any foreign assistance to hold this poll, saying they'll do it all themselves without foreign interference. Fayulu, who says he will refuse to use a voting machine and will insist on a paper ballot, says the elections have been a mess from the start.
The elections, you know, the organization is the worst organization. I never seen a country organizing election and doing what is being done here in this country, starting for the electoral register.
Shadari's camp disputes these claims and says they are confident the poll will be up to standard. Andre Elena Tundu, a spokesman for the ruling coalition and a close associate of Shadari's, says he thinks continuity is important and that it will happen no matter who wins.
If it's Mr. Shadari, he say, I'll continue with the spirits of progress impelled by Mr. Kabila. He's honest. The order will take advantage of what Mr. Kabila have left. It's a question of honesty. I think every next president will continue what Mr. Kabila has no opportunity to achieve.
As the poll nears, election paraphernalia is everywhere in the capital, with Shadari's impassive face beaming from billboards and promising economic development, security, and better infrastructure. Tshisekedi and Fayulu are far less visible on posters, but Kinshasa is an opposition stronghold, where their rallies are packed and where historically they have performed well. The visual clutter of faces and names and promises has almost become invisible to residents of the bustling capital, who decline to stop and talk about politics when asked. But as December 23rd edges ever closer, everyone is wondering, in which direction will Congo go? Anita Powell, VOA News, Kinshasa.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hello, friends. This is Sunday Shomari host, Let's Talk. Join me Monday for another exciting edition of your show. Our topic will be superstition. This will be Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
And this is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports, with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, church and civil society groups say the ongoing conflict in the English parts of Cameroon has taken a heavy toll on residents. They express concern about the ongoing killings allegedly carried out by separatists as well as soldiers from the National Army. They are calling on regional, continental and the international community to put pressure on the administration in Yaoundé to engage in dialogue to end the conflict. Their remarks came after President Paul Biya ordered that all legal proceedings against more than 100 separatists arrested for attempting to create an English-speaking country were freed Friday. For analysis, I reach Christopher Ndong, a lawyer based in the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
This month, there have been a lot of killings in the northwest and in the southwest region, coming from both sides, both from the separatists and both from government military. We have last week death of persons in Jakiri in the northwest region. In So, you come down to Moliko in Boya, southwest. You have Munya, Ekona, Muyuka, Kumba killings. So this killing that has been going on, it is not yet ceased. We are hearing, they said, the President of the Republic signed a decree putting in place the Disarmament Commission, which has been getting mixed feelings among the Anglophones. We say you cannot be talking about disarmament when war is ongoing. Disarmament process starts when war is finished, dialogue engaged. Then now they call on the people to drop arms.
Don't you think that this entire conflict reviewed in order to find ways of resolving this conflict, because people are being killed every day, as you clearly stipulated?
And you see, the people who are being killed are innocent civilians. Who, nearer or far off, they are not involved in this crime. Properties are being destroyed. Houses are burned. Their businesses destroyed. People have run and they are dying in the bushes, in the forest. Some are rushing to foreign countries as refugees. The Paramount phone called me yesterday. For so many months of the year, he ran and came here. Womb, difficult to get to womb. If you go to the northwest in Anglophone region, southwest, you hardly see mad people again. All of them have been crossed off because a madman does not know this is danger. It's just, and they are no more existing. It tells you the gravity of the situation in the northwest and southwest.
I understand trash has been piling up in cities. Corpses can be seen on roadways. Businesses have gone bankrupt. School buildings remain empty. And the list of hardship things are really getting exacerbated. But they blame the people or the so-called Ambazonia fighters or the so-called leaders in the English-speaking areas as the cause of this problem, and that they are to blame for what is being meted out to them. What do you say to that?
Yes, you can today start thinking you are blaming the Ambazonia forces. These are frustrated gentlemen. These are people pushed to with their back on the wall. They have nothing but self-defense is a legality. Their brothers and sisters and leaders have been caught and locked up in Yaoundé, Bamenda, Douala, Bafoussam, and are being judged arbitrarily for things that they don't do.
So let me ask you, what is the way forward to resolving this?
The way forward is simple. We have said it over 3 years that, one, release all those who were locked up, caught and locked up in all these places and names. Release all of them unconditionally. And then now, pass general amnesty for those who ran away from this country, from this problem. Grant general amnesty, they will come back home. And then now you make sure you make possibilities, government will make the possibilities so where those who are in the refugee camp in Nigeria, those who are in the forest, will come out. And then the third factor, you cannot call them without building their home because their property, their home, their farm, everything was destroyed. It is just looking like a desert in the suburbs, in the villages. Build back those places. When you build them back, you call them, they'll come and enter somewhere. At least they will start their life. You now keep a fund ready for them to kickstart their life. So you try to do some re-socialization that the people will try to catch up bit by bit. They will catch up in economic activity, their local economic activity. And then, within which period, the fifth point is call for national inclusive dialogue of all the stakeholders. then now sit down the round table and try to find out what is the major problem. The problem they want is, one, to have maximum autonomy to handle their own affairs, run their region.
Christopher Ndong is a Cameroonian lawyer. He spoke with me from Yaoundé. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sport. South Africa on Friday submitted a bid to be replacement hosts for next June's Africa Cup of Nations finals. South Africa and Egypt are the two countries now in line to take over the hosting of the tournament from June 15th to July 13th, 2019, after the Confederation of African Football, CAF, last month stripped Cameroon of the right to hold the tournament. South Africa Football Association, SAFA, spokesperson Dominic Chimhavi on Saturday said the association had also asked CAF to provide more clarity on the hosting requirements, as the replacement hosts have only 6 months to prepare. It has been assumed all along that Morocco, who had said 18 months ago that they were ready to step in and help if Cameroon were found incapable of hosting, would be the next hosts. South Africa last hosted the Africa Cup of Nations in 2013 when Nigeria beat Burkina Faso in the final to lift the trophy. Now CAF, who are still to confirm the identity of any other candidates who submitted their intention by the midnight Friday deadline, will have to choose between two countries with long-established infrastructure. South Africa hosted the tournament in 1996 when it was first expanded to 16 teams from 12 previously, and again in 2013 as replacements for Libya. The country's 2010 World Cup infrastructure is all still in place and being used for football regularly, except for Johannesburg's Ellis Park, which has gone back to being an exclusively rugby venue. CAF will make a decision on the 2019 hosts at its executive committee meeting in Dakar on January 9th. Meanwhile, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has confirmed that the 2018 Africa Super Cup will be played in Qatar, moving away from Africa for the first time. The fixture pits the African Champions League winners, Esperance of Tunisia, against the African Confederation Cup champions, Raja Casablanca of Morocco. The match is traditionally played at the home of the Champions League winners, although it has previously been played elsewhere in Africa. Qatar will host the 2022 FIFA World Cup. Still in football, Liverpool and Egypt striker Mohamed Salah has won the prestigious BBC Africa Football of the Year award for the second time in a row. The 26-year-old, who beat Mehdi Benatia, Kalidou Koulibaly, Sadio Mane and Thomas Partey to the award, is just the second player after JJ Okocha to win it 2 years running. Yaya Toure is the only other player to have twice won the award in its current form, while Nwankwo Kanu won it twice when it was a broader Africa Sports Personality of the Year award. Salah scored 44 goals in 52 games for Liverpool last season and helped them to reach the Champions League final. His club form has continued this season with his winner against Napoli on Tuesday that saw the Reds into the Champions League last 16, taking his tally to 13. He also scored twice for Egypt at the World Cup in Russia. Meanwhile, the CAF Awards 2018 shortlist nominees were named last week. In the African Player of the Year category, the nominees are Alex Iwobi of Nigeria and Arsenal, Andre Onana of Cameroon and Ajax, Anis Badri of Tunisia and Esperance, Dennis Onyango of Uganda and Mamelodi Sundowns, Mehdi Benatia of Morocco and Juventus, Mohamed Salah of Egypt and Liverpool, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang of Gabon and Arsenal, Riyad Mahrez of Algeria and Manchester City, Sadio Mane of Senegal and Liverpool, and Walid Soliman of Egypt and Ahly. The awards gala to honor footballers and officials who distinguished themselves during the year under review will be held on Tuesday, January 8th, 2019 in Dakar, Senegal. Finally, in tennis, mothers returning to tennis will have increased protection for their rankings on the WTA Tour from next season. Players coming back from childbirth or injury will now be able to use their previous ranking to enter 12 tournaments over a 3-year period. But Serena Williams' wish for returning mothers to be seated in line with the ranking has not been granted. The WTA has instead decided to guarantee they will not face a seeded player in a tournament's opening round. Those rules also apply to players returning from injury. And that's about all the time we have for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. And you will be hearing from Ali Kiba with Lupela Chidama, Falling in Love. If you are featuring Mr. Easy on Mami.
What a love, 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 what a love. Just tell me
From Diamond Platinum featuring Omarion, African Beauty. But before then, you heard from Ifya featuring Mr. Easy on Mami, Chidama in Falling in Love, and Ali Kiba with Lupela. And that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, United States National Security Advisor John Bolton delivered a speech at the conservative-leaning Hegstedt Foundation in Washington, D.C. In the speech entitled U.S. New Strategy for Africa, Mr. Bolton made a hard-hitting comments about the role of China and Russia in the African continent. He accused both countries of using dubious and unethical measures to promote their interests in the African continent. There are Africans who were at the meeting, and at the end they said they would wait for more details before making any pronouncements. At the face value, the speech itself was not new. In the recent years and months, many Western media officials and some government officials have expressed concern about the spread of China's influence in the African continent, particularly referring to the debt issues that China is giving too much debt to African countries. The Africans have also said that they would not rush to make a decision or choice. And some African heads of state and government have in the past said that African leaders are mature enough to make a decision themselves as to whether their relations with China is fruitful for the continent. But it is important that we look at some of the items used. For example, with regards to Djibouti, in previous commentaries, we have noted that two NATO countries, France and the United States, have long established bases in Djibouti, and China is only a newcomer. Previously, only India has expressed concern about the presence of China in the Horn of Africa and in the Indian Ocean. With respect to peacekeeping, Africans may welcome the comments of Mr. Bolton about unproductive peacekeeping in Africa, because they themselves have been making criticism about peacekeeping in Africa, but these have gone unheeded. Two African governments, the DRC and South Sudan, have even called for the withdrawal of peacekeeping forces from their country. This commentator began his career in the UN with the practice of peacekeeping and deployment of troops on the field under the tutelage of the great Dr. Ralph Bunche, and could attest that there had been a shift in peacekeeping of the UN, particularly on the African continent. I think what the U.S. and the other five permanent members must ask themselves is, how is it possible for one permanent member, France, with extensive interest in the African continent, to be in charge of peacekeeping for over 20 years, something which is unprecedented? It is also important to note that the U.S. policy in Africa has been a little confusing at times when you take into account, for example, the speech made last week in Brussels by Secretary of State Pompeo. And maybe one clarification that Africans would need from the U.S. is this specific remark by Mr. Bolton. Quote, he said, "Under our new approach, every decision we make, every policy we pursue, and every dollar of aid we spend will further U.S. priorities in the continent." This is in contrary to what China is saying. China responded quickly to Mr. Bolton's speech and said that China has pursued its policy in Africa without interfering in the domestic affairs of the African countries. And this policy of China may have to be put against the thrust of U.S. policy in Africa. In any event, Africans are saying that they welcome the speech as a drift away from what was considered benign neglect of the continent by the United States to more engagement, particularly on trade and the fight against terrorism. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, he who throws a stone in the market will hit his relative. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.